Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
See new things, try new things, go back centuries while living in the moment, forge new paths while discovering old ones, pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Hi, hello there. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, that woman who loves mythology to an absolutely ridiculous degree, Liv. And gods, today I am joined by the author of a new retelling of none other than Cupid and Psyche. The novel is called Psyche and Eros. Yeah, we're putting her up first. And oh my, do I know how much you all love that story to the degree where I probably put unnecessary pressure on today's guest by telling her as much. The number of times that I've asked about people's favorite episodes and heard how much you all love those early episodes I did on Cupid and Psyche, it's wild. Truly, I love how much you all love it. And while this story is what really got me into loving mythology as much as I do, so it was only right that I spoke with Luna McNamara about this new retelling, which is not only a new take on the story of these characters, but one featuring so much more than the traditional myth, the traditional story even, and in such a distinctly Greek myth realm, rather than, you know, its Roman origins. We prefer the Greek, let's be honest. So Luna and I talked about that. We talked about myth and retelling it broadly, using it in your own words, your own story. We talked about Psyche and Eros as characters and everyone in between. We had so much fun and had so much to say, so let's not dwell on this intro when we can get right into exactly that. Conversations, modern mythologizing, Hellenizing Apuleius, Psyche and Eros with Luna McNamara.
You know, to be transparent, I did invent and change and subvert and twist a lot because it's a story that's been out for 1800 years. And also it's just, it's such a strange and evocative story that there's a lot you can play around with there. And then there are also questions of reception and interpretation in general that I was really interested in, because I'm very interested in what could be, not necessarily what is. Like, I don't want to jump to the most obvious interpretation. I kind of want to play around with, like, well, what if we see this from this perspective? What if that aspect is actually misunderstood and it's this other adjacent thing? Since the myths didn't come down to us carved on tablets from Mount Sinai, like, these were oral traditions that were eventually written down that had different traditions in different regions. And I'm always curious about, like, what was left out? What was changed? What are the versions that we didn't get to hear?
You're basically just hosting my podcast for me at this point. So, okay, we're going to jump right in. I'm going to keep all of what you just said because it was brilliant. But, like, and I say that specifically because, so that's what I talk about, like, every episode these days, because especially for the last, like, few years, like, when I started my show, I was very, like, surface level and just kind of finding whatever, because I really just, like, started this on a whim and it blew up in a good way. But for the last years, like, I'm obsessed with ancient sources. All I ever talk about is what's missing, fragmentary, what have you. So I want to start exactly right there, which is that, like, in, excuse me in advance if I mess up and say Cupid and Psyche, because that's in my head and I know your book is Psyche and Eros. But my brain is going to go to the one that I've been reading for like 30 years and I'm going to do my best. But this myth is so interesting because in any kind of detailed form, or really, like, in almost the entire form itself, it appears exclusively in this Roman author, right? Apuleius, who wrote this story. Yes, that's the best
right
translation,
here.
The Golden Ass, yes. The Sarah Rudin translation to the listeners.
Yes.
That's the one I used in the old episodes. Like, it is absolutely the best translation. It's so, like, oh yeah, it's so hardcore. It's the best.
And plus, it's fun. She really, yes. I think, hones in on the wackiness of Apuleius,
exactly.
Which is yes. Truly, like, only in Apuleius can you get, like, scatological donkey humor and these transcendent visions of celestial goddesses. Like, it's a delight.
It's like, it's the Venus in that translation that, like, sings to my soul. She's so weird and, like, over the top and, like, ridiculous. I just love it so much. But
and super bitchy in a
see,
very delightful
is.
Way. Like,
yes.
She's so mean. I love a good female villain.
Oh my god, absolutely. No, she is precious. And so, like, but this story is so unique in that way. And so I know you went about it in Greek, to, like, as a Greek a Greek story. And so, like, I want to talk about that too. But one of the things that's most interesting, and I realize I haven't looked into it in, like, a lot of depth recently, but, like, Psyche appears in Greek myth, but the any kind of, like, idea that their love story, as it appears in Apuleius, like, doesn't have surviving sources in Greek, really. Just, like, she as a person does, and, like, an association with Eros. But it's so fascinating to me that this incredibly detailed, incredibly memorable, like, everyone's favorite kind of story that appears only in Apuleius, like, doesn't kind of have more grounding elsewhere. And so, I mean, I'm just kind of curious, like, how you wanted to go about it, what you were thinking when you were like, I'm going to make this Greek, which I would do too, by the way, because it needs to be Greek. I'm exclusively, like, I mean, I like to
you get it. You
yeah.
Get
Greek
it.
Is
I
the
appreciate
best.
That.
Greek is the only way to go. Absolutely. So yeah, like, kind of how did you want to go about that? Because it is this, like, super unique story that is both explicitly Roman, but also, like, so deeply Greek at the same time.
Yeah, so part of my choice is situated in mainland Greece around 1200 before the Common Era, roughly. A lot of that came from, like, what you were saying before about thinking about these other versions that were left out. Where did Apuleius get his idea? And, like, from what I've heard from contemporary scholars who specialize in this myth, is it seems like Apuleius mostly made it up, but he did draw on previous sources and stories, and especially artistic traditions. There are depictions of Eros and Psyche dating back to the Archaic period. There's not a ton, and there's not really any other major written sources, but and it's such a unique story, especially where it appears in The Golden Ass, where you hear the story after Lucius, who's been turned into a donkey by some witches, gone through some adventures. He's been captured by bandits, and there's this other young woman named Charite, who has also been captured, and she is on the eve of her wedding, she was going to marry her beloved. And now she's been taken by these bandits and she's terrified she's going to be raped. And it's an old woman at the bandits' camp who tells the story to her. And the story itself, as we get it from Apuleius, is very, very vague about its own origins. He just says, like, in a certain city. And there's mention of Miletus, which would be in Asia Minor, which was a Greek colony. So it's like, okay, so there's kind of a Greek connection there. But a lot of it was, I also wanted to riff on and reference some contemporary sources as well as Apuleius. So I was really interested in commenting on the modern cultural zeitgeist of these Trojan War retellings. Mm. We have Silence of the Girls from Pat Barker. We have Circe by Madeline Miller. We have Thousand Ships by our girl Natalie Haynes. There's a lot of interest in the Trojan War right now, and I think some of it comes from the fact that at least the U.S. Had these military interventions and wars in Afghanistan that went on for decades. It really didn't do a lot of good. So I wanted to kind of comment on a perspective of the Trojan War from the people who didn't fight in it, for people who are just sort of on the margins. Like, we're getting a little bit into the novel now, but Psyche is related to Agamemnon and Menelaus and Iphigenia in my version. And so she kind of has this perspective on the Trojan War that's like, okay, why are we doing this? Why are we putting our resources into this? So I was interested in commenting on that. And also, I just like the Greeks. I studied Greek. I never studied Latin. But I think in a lot of Greek sources, you see this striving and restlessness and curiosity about the world that I feel like you don't always get from the Romans. So yeah, a bit of that is my own bias.
I mean, I'm with you. We're on exactly the same side here. I've made it like a running joke in my show to just talk about how much better the Greeks are. Just objectively, they're just so much better. Like, sorry.
It's really, oh man, you try to compare Valerius Flaccus's Argonautica to Apollonius Rhodius's and you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
This is really...
I haven't even read the Latin one because why bother?
It's truly, yeah, it's not worth the price of admission. So yeah, some of my own biases about what I wanted to explore and then also what I wanted to comment on as well. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. I have so many topics that I'm going to try to also have ADHD and I'm on a new medication. So bear with my brain. All right. So one of the things that comes up, I think, a lot now when it comes to the myth of Cupid and Psyche, like, so the story itself is that, like, for all that it's this love story that I personally love, like, it's one of the first myths I think I ever had access to when I was really young. And so, like, probably from the time I was 10, like, I've had this in my mind as, like, my favorite story. And it's like, it's also spawned so many other things, right? Like, Beauty and the Beast is, like, basically a play on it, and everything from there, which is sort of fascinating in itself. But when we look at it now, there's, like, a lot of stuff where you're like, maybe this is a bit more problematic than we might have thought before. And so, you know, like, there's a lot of, abduction, just being imprisoned somewhere and then falling in love. Like, I love it, but I'm also like, wow, I love it because it's problematic. And, like, you know, we can like tropey stuff. But, like, so how did you kind of want to go about that? Like, what were you thinking when it comes to those aspects of it that are kind of inherently...
No, you're exactly right. And that's actually something I really had to the forefront of my mind when I was writing this novel, because like you, I think I was at summer camp when I first heard the story the first time. It was told around the fire. And there are so many aspects of it that are really gorgeous. Like, you have these two individuals who are falling in love with each other in the darkness. You know, she comes in with the lamp and the razor. They're separated and she has to undergo these trials to find him again. Like, it's really beautiful stuff. But then when you dig into the sources, it's a lot of weird shit, Liv.
Exactly. It's a really big combination of, like, absolutely a beautiful love story and stuff where you're like, huh, right, okay. Yeah, well, that happened.
Exactly. And I had mentioned listening to your episode with Natalie Haynes where you were talking about Stone Blind, which... Amazing book, by the way. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Loved the interview, too.
Thank you.
But there isn't this concern with consent in ancient sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I was rereading Apuleius to prep for this interview, and there's this quote when Psyche is first brought to Eros's house, and it's dark, and he goes to bed with her. And they mention, like, that it's clear in the original Apuleius they have sex that first night, and I don't know how much Psyche's into it. And there's this mention of these disembodied voices in the house tending to the bloody corpse of the new bride's virginity.
Oh, like,
not the stuff of grand romance. Don't love that. So as I was thinking about retelling this, I honed in a lot on the characters of Psyche and Eros and thought about who they might be outside of the strictures of Apuleius, like what might have been the sort of igniting forces or the seeds for the story that Apuleius eventually told. And with Psyche, I wanted to create someone who wasn't afraid to find herself in this new house, not because she wasn't intelligent enough to figure out what it meant, but just because fear didn't occur to her.
Mm.
So what kind of person would that be? And there are also places throughout the myth, as it's told in Apuleius, where she shows incredible strength of character, even in that original version. Like when she's being marched away to the peak to be left to the monster, she turns around and gives this speech that's basically like, don't cry for me. This is my destiny. I'm going to face it. And then later on, when she's separated from Eros, she survives in the wilderness, petitions these goddesses, gets revenge on her sisters, which we'll get to that later. I don't love that part either. And does all these incredible things and does these things pregnant. So I really wanted to hone in on the agency and strength of Psyche and really do away with that corpse of the new bride's virginity stuff.
So horrifying phrase. Like, I can't
it's
quite get
really,
over that.
Yeah, isn't that awful? It's really gross. So in my version, I have Psyche and Eros spending a lot more time together. Also, I truly believe when you have two characters that you want to tell a story about them getting together, but there's a lot of distance, send them on a quest. Have them do an epic quest together.
Yep.
So that's what happens in my version. And there's more of an organic build to their first time having sex and to their romance and to their marriage eventually.
Yeah. It's I mean, I like that because it's like, I mean, it's basically just a perfect way of like modernizing the story and making it like, I want to say palatable. I mean something better, but like, you know what I mean in that, like, because there are so many unpalatable parts of the myth where it's like you take the story that the good parts of those stories and like place it into this world and these people that are so much more like, attuned to like modern people and modern women broadly. Cause I imagine that, you know, you were thinking really strongly about like the women characters. I mean, I realize I'm assuming this, but with most retellings these days, I feel like it's fairly safe. But like, yeah, focusing more on like a stronger woman character. And Psyche is, like you were saying, which is sort of so interesting about her broadly in myth, because so many women are not like that and not given the chance in the sources to be strong. And that's not to say that there weren't stories of strong women and that women in the ancient world weren't strong and telling stories of strong women. But in terms of like what survives to us, most of the time, if they're not a goddess, like the women are just kind of there and things are just happening to them. And so taking that and like making it about her must have been so much more like fulfilling.
Yeah. And I think the bones of it are really there with the Eros and Psyche myth. Like, even in Apuleius, like Psyche is the one who does the hero's tasks.
That's like, what's so exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the sorting of the grain, the gathering of the fleece, the fetching of Persephone's beauty from the underworld. Like, these are heroic tasks in parallel to the labors of Hercules, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being done by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty neat.
It's gotta be the only Apuleius version that has that, or only source that like has that kind of story of a woman doing that.
It's really, there might be others, but I would have to really think about and dig for them. And
even
so
Atalanta doesn't have that. Sorry. My brain's going to all the different places. But
oh,
yeah.
I do love Atalanta.
Oh, yeah.
Guess who shows up in Psyche and Eros?
Yes.
Atalanta. Yeah. I had a lot of fun writing her.
Yeah.
And she shows up in book two again, which we can get to later in the interview. The bones of this kind of interesting, complicated, powerful woman interpretation of Psyche are there in Apuleius. It is interesting. Apuleius seems like he kind of wants to drag down Psyche a lot. Like, there's a lot of tears. There's a lot of saying she should kill herself when she can't, you know, immediately finish the labors. But, you know, how much of that is faithful to the mythologem itself, and how much of that is, you know, some of Apuleius's biases and some of Apuleius making the story palatable to his readers mm-hmm. in the second century CE. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in honing in on that. And again, I like to riff on and pull in other sources as well, because I think in my opinion, what makes myth retellings and reimaginings interesting is the changes that the author makes to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I've read Apuleius, I've read Homer, I've read these guys, I know their version of the story, I want to hear yours. So I personally, as a writer, love pulling in other sources. And one of the sources I pulled in was C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, mm-hmm. which is another retelling of mm-hmm. the Eros and Psyche myth from the perspective of Psyche's sister. Mm-hmm. And C.S. Lewis makes a lot of changes as well. And with that perspective that he has on the story, it's very shifted. Mm-hmm. But the sister's name is Orual. She becomes the queen of this country, and she's very much a martial warrior queen. So I was like, well, hey, Psyche's already doing these heroic labors. What if I draw in some of that? And so I shifted the prophecy from Apuleius that Psyche would marry a monster to the prophecy that Psyche would conquer a monster. Mm-hmm. And we can also say some things about parallels between conquering and marriage in the ancient world, and yep. how that might have gotten mixed up and misunderstood by the priests of the Oracle of Delphi. But I thought it was an interesting kickoff point for the novel. Mm-hmm.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I read Till We Have Faces like a million years ago now, probably like 15 years. And I'm like, crap, I really haven't read that in a while. I don't remember much about it, except that it was like, yeah, these sort of different perspectives. But I'm glad to be reminded of it. So you brought up like kind of exactly what I was going to go into next, which is that I know, especially with the hero's journey and like all of these things that you wanted to do. And sorry, now my brain's going to go in a couple different places, but like yeah. one, it is my favorite thing when authors want to bring in all these different things and invent things alongside the myth, because personally, as someone who spends, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week at absolute minimum reading the ancient sources and the myths, like I don't find the same entertainment in a retelling that is just the myth, because I'm like, but I know what's going to happen because it happened already. And so it is so nice to have those ones that have these changes, have these inclusions of other stories and all these different like author inventions that make it kind of your own. And so I know with yours, you brought in like a bunch of other Greek myths, like you said, Atalanta, and I know Prometheus is in there. And so like, how did you want to go about including those other myths? Like, did you include some just because they're your favorites? Like, I just love to hear about that kind of whole process.
Absolutely. So that was actually one of my favorite parts of writing this. And the way I thought about connecting these other stories was basically, okay, so if I follow the trajectory of Psyche and Eros throughout Apuleius's version, they do bump into the myths of other people. So like in Apuleius's version, the west wind appears to ferry Psyche from the cliff top to Eros's house. It ferries Psyche's sisters there as well. But the west wind is a personage in mythological sources. The west mm-hmm. wind is Zephyrus, who mm-hmm. has his own set of myths. And one of the ones that I thought was most interesting is Zephyrus's romance with Hyacinthos, which mm-hmm. who is a mortal youth who is like very beautiful. And Zephyrus gets into this love triangle with Apollo over Hyacinthos. And Hyacinthos is eventually killed by a discus to the head, mm-hmm. turns into the hyacinth flower. But what is that like for Zephyrus to fall mm-hmm. in love with this young man so intensely and then to see him die and then to keep living after that?
Yeah.
And Obviously, that has a lot of resonance to the love story between Psyche and Eros, which is also a romance between a god and a mortal. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to draw that in as well. And I also wanted to play around with Zephyrus as a character and as a friend for Eros, because he's just a form of transportation in Apuleius, but he has these rich connections to other mythological sources.
Yeah.
And it was similar with Persephone as well. So at the end of Apuleius's version, well, towards the end of Apuleius's version, Psyche has to do her catabasis, descent to the underworld, to get the jar of beauty from Persephone. But Persephone also has all these other myths around her about being a young woman who is abducted to the underworld. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of a spoiler for my book, I did not see Hades and Persephone as a love story in this. I see it as a kidnapping and as something that Persephone has to endure, but eventually claws her way to a place of major power in the underworld.
It is interesting to take that perspective, and minimally, as my listeners will know, I prefer the perspective that Persephone was abducted and yes, took on immense power. So I love to hear that.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's this kind of terrific goth underworld queen.
As she should be.
who really had to claw her way there. And yeah. Hades doesn't really show up at all. She's really the power behind the throne, even though she's only there half the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I drew from other sources as well. Like Apollonius Rhodius's Argonautica, Persephone is the one to send up the shade of this Greek hero.
Mm-hmm.
In the Odyssey, Persephone is the mm-hmm. one to send the souls of the women to talk to Odysseus. And it's like, there's so many other little examples of Persephone as the power in the underworld that you want to yeah. please. And I was like, oh, that's cool.
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite. She really is it. Like, Hades yeah. is just kind of there.
Yeah. He kind of, you know, he was like a legacy brat. He yeah. nepotism baby. He got exactly. the job. But like, she's the one who runs shit.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also just narratively such an interesting foil to Psyche as two young women who were suddenly brought or dragged to their husband's house, but Psyche's ending is loving and happy, and Persephone's is, I think happy in the end because she obtains this power for herself, but mm. I don't view it as a loving marriage between her and Hades.
Mm-hmm.
And additionally, I was really interested in the myth of Adonis as well, mm-hmm. who is this young mortal man. Both Persephone and Aphrodite fall in love with him. He's killed by a boar. And the way I rewrote that was Eros gets involved.
Hmm.
So Persephone asks Eros for a favor, and Eros is like, I get to screw over Aphrodite? Great. And shoots Adonis with an arrow. Unfortunately, as Adonis is boar hunting and distracts him, and oh no, I guess Persephone is going to see her boyfriend sooner than she expected. So that's the way I went about folding the other myths in, was I looked for the places where the story of Psyche and Eros collided with the stories of others.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, to be fair, I took some liberties. There are a couple places where I really made them meet. So there is a part where Psyche has a conversation with Medusa, where Medusa calls into question these ideals of a hero that Psyche has, you know, kind of followed her whole life. And Medusa's like, really? You think killing things is heroic? Go feed someone. You know how many people are starving?
That's very Medusa. I love that.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I if you're going to have someone call into question these ideals of heroism, it's gotta be Medusa.
It really
we gotta
does.
Give her a voice. Ugh. Love her.
Yeah, she's my all-time favorite. I'm notorious in my show, which is that I will talk and about her at any given time and forever. And also, I will defend forever that even the oldest surviving source of her does include a Poseidon assaulting her, and it's not consensual, even in Hesiod. And I will defend that to the death. But yeah, anyway, Medusa's the best, and certainly like, as a person who, yeah, has anything to say against heroes, it's the woman who was killed by Perseus just because he wanted yep. her head and no other
yep.
reason at all. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Have you heard the song Medusa by Kaylee Morg?
Yes.
Okay. If you hadn't, I was going to send it to you after the show because I love that song. It's so good.
It's like on a playlist that plays all the time, but alongside so many other mythology songs. Like I have this myth playlist. And so I'm like trying to piece it all out. But I know, that I've heard it a million times. And the minute it would start playing, I would know every second of it. Yeah, I mean, she's the absolute best. So I'm thrilled to hear that she's included. Yeah, I mean, that's just so wonderful. I love the inclusion of so many other stories and things. So, like, I mean, and this might have, kind of already been sort of half answered by what you've been talking about here. But, like, were there any myths, and maybe the ones that are more, like, not directly related to Apuleius that you really just, like, loved a character or a story so much that you're like, I'm going to slot it in here because I can make it work and I want to?
I mean, Medusa has to be one of them because, like, I was listening to your interview with Natalie Haynes and all the stuff you were saying, like, about the original sources, it being non-consensual, and also the fact that Medusa isn't on record as killing anyone.
Exactly.
With the whole eyes stone thing, which takes a lot of effort.
Yep.
So I have a soft spot for Medusa. I had to get her in there.
Yeah.
And then Atalanta is probably one of the bigger liberties I took. So there, in my version, there's the prophecy that Psyche will conquer the monster. Her parents are like, oh yeah, girl's going to be a hero. Great. Oh, I need to find her a teacher. Well, we can't apprentice her to Chiron because he's a centaur and she's a girl, and that, centaurs are like. Maybe we could get an Amazon. Well, no, they tend to die in captivity and you can't pay them. What about Atalanta? So Atalanta is Psyche's teacher in this, partly because I wanted to highlight and emphasize that kind of heroic thread, but also because Atalanta is one of my all-time favorite figures from Greek mythology. I love her. I loved writing her as well as this sort of, like, cranky, laconic, and yet also affectionate mentor figure. So that's one of the bigger liberties I took, but it was also one of the more fun ones.
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? Like, I mean, one, as writing a novel, like, you can and should take whatever liberties you want, but it's nice to have that specific type where you're like, I took this liberty because I really wanted to talk about Atalanta. And it's like, that's the best thing about, I think, mythology broadly, but also, like, specifically these retellings, is that, like, I mean, especially with how many there are now coming out all the time, like, particularly this year, like, the more liberties you take, the more your book is going to be sort of set apart from a lot of the retellings in an interesting way. And especially when it comes to these women characters, like, gods, the more the better, you know? And Atalanta is so fascinating.
She's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
See new things, try new things, go back centuries while living in the moment, forge new paths while discovering old ones, pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
Okay, I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
I did this 2-episode series on her like a year ago, I think, where I kind of, because she's really interesting, and this is sort of my obsession with ancient and fragmentary sources that's so specific to her, which is that like we have this kind of idea that maybe there were two Atalantas who did almost the same thing, but like one's from Boeotia and one's from Arcadia. And I think that that is so fascinating. And so what I did was like separate them and do 2 different episodes of like, this is the Boeotian Atalanta, and I kind of stand by like the Boeotian Atalanta is the heroic Atalanta that we think of, the Caledonian boar, like the one who's doing these like traditionally masculine things, whereas this Arcadian Atalanta, and I'm hoping not mixing it up, but I'm pretty sure I'm not, but the Arcadian Atalanta is the one who like loses the foot race. And you're like, I don't understand how a woman who can fight the Caledonian boar and go amongst the Argonauts and like just kick all the ass in the whole world would then be like, shiny thing, you know, and like lose a foot race that cost her, you know, relationship because of that. And I actually also spoke with Jennifer Saint recently about her novel, Atalanta. And so it was interesting the way she kind of handled that too, because it is such a, it sort of feels out of place for her character. Anyway, that's sort of like my Atalanta like ramble, but she just really is so fascinating, especially when it comes to these kind of like very fragmentary aspects of her, where there's so many questions that, you know, a person can answer if they're so inclined in a retelling.
Yeah, exactly. And also like the role of love and romance in Atalanta's life, I think is really interesting, because famously this is someone who really doesn't want to marry, but she has this very close, affectionate, mutually respectful relationship with Meleager.
Yes.
Who kills his own family members to defend her honor when they try to take the pelt of the Caledonian boar away from her. Like, let's put, kills his own family members in ancient Greece.
Yeah, not good.
Not good. Quite shocking. And then she also has this, she has the foot race with Hippomenes Melanion, like, couple different names in the sources. God, yeah. The sources love doing that to us. And they do seem to have, they seem to have had an affectionate, respectful marriage there. Like they end up banging in the Temple of Rhea and getting turned into lions. So yeah. Like clearly they liked each other. But for someone who doesn't want to marry, to have these two extremely significant, affectionate, mutually respectful relationships with apparently some quite intense physical chemistry if you're bopping each other in a temple. So I was interested to explore that as well, and to think about this combination of fierce independence, heroism, and romance as well in the life of Atalanta, and how that reflects some of what Psyche goes through as well in my novel. And also I had to write about Atalanta.
Well, yeah.
I love her.
Yeah,
so
you just
cool.
Gotta. I get that.
You gotta.
Yeah. I mean, I love the story of Cupid and Psyche so much. And it really is like, I feel like we've already said this, but my brain just wants to kind of harp on it. But this idea of like, yeah, like it reminded me talking about Atalanta, but like it really is so, not only is there like mutual love and passion with Cupid and Psyche, which is so rare in ancient stories, but then yeah, this same idea that like not only that, but she saves him in every possible way. And it just, yeah, this is not leading to a question or anything, but just must have been so satisfying to work with a story like that, because especially if you, you know, are somebody who focuses primarily on Greece, like we both have done and do, like it is considerably more rare or like almost non-existent in Greek sources. And so to be able to like play with this story that exists and then turn it into your own. I just feel like there's so much there.
Yeah. And it was, this was a very much a pandemic project.
Mm.
And came out of a pretty dark time in my own life when I was living in a tiny one bedroom apartment in Boston when the pandemic hit. So it was a lot of like, all right, here I am in my room, can't leave the house. Went through some pretty significant health issues, some interpersonal stuff, like breakup. I was laid off from my job.
Oh my God, everything.
And I was like, oh my God, like I'm stuck in this room. What am I going to do? All right. I always like this myth. I have this idea for I guess I'm going to work on that. I don't have anything else to do. And it really became something I dug into. I looked through the different sources, different mythological sources, thought about the kind of story I wanted to piece together. And that's what I really focused on in this pretty miserable time.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I feel like a lot of, I mean, novels generally, and especially retellings kind of came from that in a nice way. It's almost like, I don't know. It personally, like I started just working on the podcast more. So I also dove deeper into myth as like a thing I was already doing. And it, especially myth, I think was a really nice escape from that because it is just so separated from real life.
Yeah. And like to get away from this nightmare of isolation and CNN and overrun emergency rooms and just dive into what this cliffside house of this god of love might look like. You know, it was very satisfying for me and became something that I'm proud of.
Yeah. That's, I mean, especially when you get it published too, like it's so exciting and what an accomplishment.
That was a wild journey. So to talk about my background a little bit, I have a master's in theological studies from Harvard Divinity School. I initially wanted to become an academic, and then I saw it was an absolute dumpster fire. You're going to be adjuncting, or maybe you'll have to move to the middle of Idaho to get a tenure track job. No shade to Idaho. but it's just, academia is brutal, and also I think much like you, what I love is jumping around and learning everything I can about something and then moving on. Mm-hmm. And academia doesn't want you to do that. It wants you to find your little molehill and really stay on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've since ended up in social work, which is an interesting journey in and of itself. Yeah, came at this with really no background in publishing, no MFA.
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of fan fiction.
Amazing.
Fun niche fact. Psyche and Eros started out as a fanfic.
Amazing. Will you tell me of what?
That's a secret.
Okay.
I will. It is funny. I will shout from the hilltop like, I'm a fanfiction writer. This started out as a fanfic. And then people ask me what fandom. And I'm like, classified.
No, I respect that. Yeah.
Somebody's probably going to figure it out someday. And kudos to them.
I also have fanfiction that exists on the internet. But it is from like the year 2001,
ooh,
which means that probably it will never be found. But I'm like, it's older for me, but I love that. Yeah, that's definitely what I started writing too.
I did recently rediscover my teenage fanfiction.net account and then immediately closed my laptop and like walked away.
I have done that.
No one will ever see this.
I have done that. Mine exists too. Yep. 2001. I was like 13 and writing fanfiction and it is still on fanfiction.net.
But I'm also just such a proponent of fanfiction because it is creativity for the sake of creativity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so vital in a world that's increasingly disconnected and high priced and, you know, based on a culture of disposability. Like fan fiction writers are doing it because they love it. And a lot of times that really shows.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true.
So it started out as fanfic.
Yeah.
And during the pandemic, I started reworking it into a novel. Started sending it out to agents around January, February of 2021. And I got a wonderful nibble of someone who requested a full manuscript. and then came back with a revise and resubmit. Because at the time, I had this kind of peculiar narrative device where it was all in first person, but omniscient narrator, and it really didn't work. So I completely rewrote it and ended up signing with another agent, my girl Hattie Grunewald, who is in the UK. Love her. Did more rewriting with her and eventually got it published. But it was a very up and down journey. It was enormous amounts of rewriting. There were a lot of moments of, do I want to keep doing this, or do I want to do literally anything else with my life? And I was like, you know, I want to see this story through. I want to see what happens with
it. Yeah. I love to hear that. So I actually, my background is in publishing and I left it very specifically. But like I did all of my schooling with the intention of being an agent, only to then work for Penguin Random House and then clearly leave very happily. But it is,
congratulations.
Thank you. It's much better on the other side. Now I remember specifically being like, I'm going to lose out all my free books when I leave this job. And I was looking at my kitchen table where I also work just the other day, and I was like, I did not lose out on my free books. I've got this like stack of like six free books of either retellings or mythology or what have you that like publishers want to send me all the time. I'm like, great, I just found a different way. It's perfect.
Good for you. And I mean, as you can see from my own career journey, I am a big fan of people who set out to do one thing and then end up doing something entirely different, which is also Psyche's character trajectory in the novel.
Yeah. Like
we start out with this hero girl thing and then we subvert it. And not because Psyche is too small for that dream, but because the dream is too small for her. So come for the girls with swords and stay for the deconstruction of the patriarchy.
I mean, if that is not like the catchphrase of my podcast, I don't know what it is. I love that. That's amazing.
Glad to hear that. Also work. You have a Cadmus and Harmonia novel, don't you? How's that
novel?
Going?
Oh, thank you for asking. That novel has been going since the year 2008, and is the reason I went to school to be an agent, and then still is not finished, and is in a very different form now. But actually, funny enough, Kate, whose episode you listened to, is currently reading it to be helpful to me, Kate Corain. Yes. And so we'll see. I don't know. I'm just kind of constantly like, I'll work on it. But then the podcast takes up a little bit of time. So, you know. Yeah. But it's going to happen eventually because Cadmus and Harmonia are my reason for living.
They are so fascinating.
They are. They're baffling, and that's what makes them so cool. There's like nothing about them.
I mean, I'm not to turn the tables on you, but I'm going to turn the tables on you. What is an aspect of the novel that you're digging into now, or something that's really come up to interest you?
So the thing that it's funny because this is a completely different novel. Like it started out as like I was like 19, I think, when I started writing it. What is math? Yeah, that sounds right. And so like it was like a 19-year-old's novel, and then I just became so obsessed though with Cadmus and Harmonia that it's like just kind of carried through with me to now becoming this like obsessive about ancient history novel. But the fun thing about them is that there really isn't much of a story, so you kind of have to invent all of it. And so the thing that I found that's sort of taken over my life is their association with the island of Samothrace, which is not always in the ancient sources, but a lot of times Harmonia comes from there. And there's more detail in like a very late and ridiculous source called Nonus. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's wacky. He wrote the longest surviving epic. It's like 48 books. It is absurd. But he wrote a lot about them. So the island of Samothrace has this like completely wild and mysterious island, not least because it has a mystery cult, is the big
oh, we
thing
love a
that
good
now
mystery cult.
And it is the second most important mystery cult of ancient Greece, and we know almost nothing about it. Like I went there actually last year, and like even to get to Samothrace, like nobody goes to Samothrace. They joked, like I swear I was like the only Canadian that's like been there in the last 5 years. And it's a fascinating place because it has this ancient sanctuary that is quite sprawling and survives pretty heavily, and like it's primarily from the Hellenistic period. But there's some classical and archaic aspects as well. And like even Linear A was found on Samothrace. Like it's a wild island. But there's this sprawling sanctuary, and there's no temple, but there's everything else. They still don't know what gods were associated with the mystery cult, but it was like a vitally important mystery cult. Like the Argonauts or they go there and they get inducted.
I was about to say, was that where Orpheus took them and they went through the mysteries there?
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of the only kind of inclusions in another larger myth. And even like the theater confuses archaeologists. So like there's a whole amphitheater, except there's no stage and it's on an angle. So it doesn't actually even face anything, any other part of the sanctuary fully. It just kind of like is an amphitheater, but like with no obvious purpose. Anyway, it's baffling and I clearly could talk about it forever, but I won't continue. But that is ultimately the answer to your question.
That is absolutely delightful. Again, we love a good mystery call.
Right.
And I didn't really know anything about Samothrace, so thank you for telling me about that.
You're so welcome. I could talk about Samothrace at any given moment. It's wild. But I mean, it gives me this sort of like interesting insight into writing a story from Greek myth, but specifically the type where like what you've worked off of is like the invented parts, the sort of changing of things, and that kind of thing is just, I don't know, it generally fascinates me broadly. Yeah, this is not leading to a question, but
that is totally fine.
Interesting.
I mean, the mystery cults are they're so fun. They're so cool.
They really are.
And for the Samothracian mystery cult, do we not have evidence for that because of a lack of written sources, or because people were actually following the don't talk about the mystery cult? First rule of mystery cult is you don't talk about the mystery cult.
I think both, because they obviously go hand in hand. But like, specifically for this one, it's associated with sailors and like safety upon the seas, but is not explicitly associated with Poseidon. The closest kind of connections we know are like Lemnos is just south of Samothrace, and obviously it's sacred to Hephaestus, and he has these gods on Lemnos called the Cabiroi, which are kind of mysterious, but we kind of know a bit about them. So the Cabiroi are associated with Samothrace, but it's more like we don't know if they were like the primary gods or who they were in terms of the wider Cabiroi. Apparently, but Aeschylus has a lost play called the Cabiroi, and like may or may not have included Samothrace. But again, it was mostly Hellenistic, which is sort of interesting in itself, because that's sort of like, it's such a interesting and like transient kind of time.
Yeah.
So it's just generally we just like don't really know much at all. But the fact that there isn't a temple, but like there's all these other buildings, like loads of people live there. The Stoa is like sprawling. It's huge, and no temple, which is
That's fascinating.
Yeah. I got to hang out with the archaeologist there when I was there and like get all these tours and stuff. So I feel like I got extra insights for sure, but just also the sort of like deep nerdery involved. Yeah, it's a wild, wild island too. Like,
that
there's
is so
more
cool.
Goats. Goats outnumber humans 10-1. They're just everywhere all the time. And I encountered more bugs than I ever have in my life. Like, they're just on me all the time. I got followed by butterflies walking down the street. Like, it's the weirdest place. I felt like a Disney princess. Like, I just could, it's bananas.
I think there still is a connection to more stuff we can talk about, because the idea of mystery cults and initiations, and also the Platonic idea of the ascent of the soul through matter, these are very much tied into the story of Eros and Psyche. And in Apuleius, where the story appears midway through, after the bandits get our boy Lucius, the Golden Ass ends not just with Apuleius being turned into a human again by this incredible apparition of the goddess Isis, who calls herself by all these different names that the Hellenistic and Roman world would have recognized, but it actually ends with Apuleius's initiations into the priesthood of Isis, Osiris, and Horus. Like, he's paying them back for what they did and recognizing them and growing as a person. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, apparent in the original version of the Psyche and Eros story, where she has to overcome these trials. But it's also something I wanted to play with as well, because not only does she eventually go through apotheosis and become a goddess herself, but she's gone to the underworld. She's undergone these trials. She is a goddess now. What do you do with that? What do you do after you've been transformed? And so the last chapter of the novel gets into that.
Ooh.
Which I won't say more about
because
spoilers. But yeah, we love a good mystery cult. We love a good initiation. It's such fascinating stuff. And Eleusis shows up a little bit because, again, the places where the Psyche and Eros story intersects with other stories, Persephone is a major one of those. Mm-hmm. And also Psyche has to sort grain, and grain is associated with Demeter. And so let's bring in Demeter and Persephone. And what a fascinating dynamic that is.
Yes.
Mythologically, but also in the novel. And just Eleusis itself was so cool, like the idea that men, women, and children throughout the Greek world could be initiated, that we still don't know a lot about the rites because people kept that vow of secrecy. And also, just this is a really fun aside, so part of the Eleusinian mysteries was bathing in the sea, and at some point, some poor guy was eaten by a shark he was bathing.
As soon as you said that, I was like, I'm going to tell the shark story. so I love that. Yes.
What gets me is, like, I just picture everyone else bathing being like, so should we keep going? Should we go home? What? Like, what did everyone else think?
Yes.
Oh my god. The poor priests or priestesses who had to lead that thing. Oh, dealing with the guy's family. What a mess.
I know. I had a guest on, Ryan Denson, who came on to talk about sea monsters, and he was the one who told me that story. And yeah, I am a shark person outside of my Greek mythology existence. And so that's my favorite story.
It's really, like, that poor guy.
Yes.
That poor
it's
guy.
So wild. Like, what are the chances? Like, sharks don't go that close to shore all that often.
Yeah.
Like, it's also just, like, a surprising shark attack story regardless.
I mean, someone wrote it down. So they're like, oh my gosh.
Like, you gotta
let people know about
happened?
This one.
Yeah. I mean, it was big news. Well, so that kind of, just the talk of Demeter and Persephone they're so wonderful, especially Eleusinian mysteries, like, yeah, I want to learn everything about that. But it sort of reminds me of something you brought up earlier to get back to, which is like the sisters in Apuleius are very, they're difficult and kind of tricky. So I'm curious, like, what your thought process was and how you wanted to handle the sisters.
Liv, I got to be honest with you. I fucking hated that part of the myth.
Yeah.
For the listeners who might not be familiar with it, Psyche has these two older sisters who, you know, after Psyche settled in at Eros's house, they come to visit her and they're like, oh, this bitch, like, she gets to marry this guy, live in this house, and we have to marry these old men, and it's awful, and we gotta get her. And so they're the ones who are like, well, maybe your husband is a monster and you should bring that lamp into the bedroom, even though he's told you not to, because he'll probably kill you and eat you. And in Apuleius, Psyche does this. They're separated. She has to undergo the trials to get Eros back. But first, she gets one over on her sisters and, like, basically tricks them into falling to their deaths. And it's just, narratively, it's fucking awful because, like, why are you having this whole aside with the sisters and vengeance when you're also looking for Eros? And to be fair, I love a good aside. There is plenty of that in my novel, but narratively, it makes no sense. And also, it just, to me, seems like such a clear place of Apuleius's own biases.
Mm-hmm. It's very anti-woman. It's like women
are
jealous. Like, yeah, they're willing to fuck over their sister because she married the good guy. Like, get a grip. Yeah.
And they're just, the characters are really, all we get from them is their jealousy. We don't really get anything else. And then Psyche kills them, even though she doesn't really kill anyone else in the Apuleius myth. So that, it's very strange narratively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it shows Apuleius's biases, as we were saying. And like Roman writers really love highlighting like how weak and susceptible women are and how jealous they are. And I was like, you know, this, I don't like this. And additionally, there are so many good reasons to be concerned about your sister when she is whisked away to a house mm-hmm. and married to a husband that she can't see. Like, that is actually something to genuinely be concerned about.
Yeah.
And that's something that C.S. Lewis really plays with in Till We Have Faces, which is written from the perspective of one of those sisters and shows that she's more than just jealousy as a personality trait. Mm-hmm. So with the sisters, that's one of, I think, the biggest changes I made in the novel, because I just made Psyche an only child, a late life baby of this king and queen of Mycenae. And instead I gave her sister-like figures. So she has Atalanta as sort of an older sister figure, as a mentor, as someone who helps train and advise her. And she also has Iphigenia, who in my version is her cousin, and who is this bright, insightful, curious child of Agamemnon, who doesn't think too highly of her because she's a daughter, but wants to become a priestess of Artemis and is very curious about this archery and fighting stuff that Psyche is doing and learns a little bit of it, but is ultimately someone who really survives by her wits and her relationships, and who is very political as well. And, you know, eventually there is some tragedy there as well, but I'll leave that to the readers. So instead, I really wanted to hone in on those sister-like relationships. And Iphigenia is the one to point out, like, Psyche, you are the only child of the king and queen of Mycenae. Whoever you marry is next for the throne. And you don't even know who your husband is? What's going
Danger.
On here?
Danger.
Yeah, this is concerning. So I really, yeah, I very much shifted around the sisters thing because it was incongruous to the narrative. It was evident of Apuleius's own biases, and I fucking hated it. So yep. I did away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's such a, like, yeah, it's such a sort of glaring, like we talked about earlier, the different parts where you're like, this is a little bit more problematic, you know, now with our modern sensibilities and things when it comes to Apuleius generally. I also have to admit, and this is my, well, I'm not even that ashamed of admitting it, I have not read much Apuleius beyond the Cupid and Psyche portion, because every time I've tried, I've just thought, this is just so Roman and weird, and I don't really care about it.
You are so right.
Yeah.
The ending with Isis and her monologue is really transcendently gorgeous.
Okay.
And the parts about his initiations into the mystery cults is really beautiful. But a lot of it is very peculiar. Some of it is very funny, but yeah, it's kind of a strange story.
Yeah. I've read some of the parts that feature witches, because I often try to, I like to do a spooky season episodes where I try to find whatever kind of, you know, that sort of vibe in the myths. But, and it's part of what has led me to just my own theories on Rome's witches versus Greek witches, which I find fascinating, which is like, in the Greek myths, we have Circe and Medea and, you know, Hecate. We have these women who are like powerful and they're goddesses and they're, you know, they're really, as much as Medea is, you know, does some bad things, like she really holds a lot of agency and power in her life.
I have a very soft spot for Medea.
I love Medea. Absolutely. Like, I mean, I can defend her a little bit too strongly, I would say, for somebody who killed her children. But
Or did she? Or was it the Corinthians?
Oh, see, I'm fine with them being her. I can stand by that. I'll still defend it. But then you have these Roman witches, like from people, I mean, like Apuleius, but then there's the other Roman poet, and I'm always going to forget, but he has this witch. And like the witches of Rome tend to be these like weird, withered old hags that are just like creating dangerous love potions to like fuck over men. In comparison to like Circe and Hecate, which I just generally find fascinating. But Apuleius is one of the places where I've sort of vaguely looked into the Roman take on witches, which just to me suggests kind of Rome's and their authors' feelings towards women, which Apuleius kind of proves in a lot of places too, like that sister moments and things.
Yeah. No, that's an excellent. I'm going to have to put that episode on my my to listen to list.
Oh God, there's so many episodes.
Hecate does show up in Psyche and Eros. I make the controversial decision to fold in more of that Roman iconography of like this old haggard woman. And also I was really inspired by the myths of the Baba Yaga, like Hecate's house is on chicken feet. Just again, because I really like it. And yeah. I think it's interesting to have as well, because the gods are so often like young and youthful, and like, what if one of them's not?
Yeah.
And then in book two, you get a little, my book two, you get a little more information about that.
I mean, here for it. God, Hecate is the best. Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like you were just able to weave in so many different characters and stories and things. Like, were there any that you really wanted to fit in because you really wanted to write about them, or stories that you really loved or whatever, where you're just like, nah, I can't make this work? Like, was there anything that was kind of left out?
I actually wanted to do more with Penelope, and my editors were like, Luna, please don't put in every single opinion you've had on every Greek myth. Like, please calm down. But Penelope is so interesting because she essentially rules Ithaca for 20 years. She manages these suitors. She has the whole stratagem with the weaving of the shroud, which, love that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really forgiven her for not stepping in to prevent the hanging of the maids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going on with that. I don't know if you were just sleepy that day, Penelope, but Your hubby killed 12 of your innocent maids, and that's kind of fucked up. But I would have loved to weave in more with Penelope, but my editors were like, please calm down.
Yeah, Penelope is so fascinating also because of the way that she is treated by others. Mm-hmm. Like, as a character, as a person in the Odyssey, I absolutely love her. Like, the Odyssey is my favorite epic by so much, and I could talk about it forever, but... And I love Penelope in it, but then what fascinates me is how other people talk about her. Like, right now I'm working on episodes covering Euripides' Orestes. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, so many, or there's at least one, like, really specific comparison, you know, of, I guess it's Clytemnestra in this case, like, but to Penelope, which, of course, poor Clytemnestra gets compared to Penelope, like, constantly because of the timelines and things. Like, yeah. In the Odyssey itself, that comparison is, like, wacky, where literally it's, you know, Menelaus, or however it works, I guess it's in the underworld, where Agamemnon's like, my wife, she killed me, not like your wife who's been like perfect this whole time. And it's like, yeah, so Penelope just has like that extra kind of depth, so I can see why you would want to talk about her some more.
And those maids, you know.
Oh yeah,
I mean, still maids, haven't forgotten them.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, even just, like, the use of the word maids, like, it's, you know, it's a reason why Emily Wilson's translation is so good, because we get, like, otherwise, a lot of the old translations just called them, like, I don't know, probably, like, whores or something horrible.
Yeah, they called them, like, sluts and harlots, and, like, these were probably quite young women who were enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's going on? I don't know.
They had no ability to control what was going on to them and are punished for it. Yeah.
And were hanged essentially for being raped by Penelope's suitors. So, I'm still thinking about the maids.
Yeah.
I still want justice for them.
Dudes in ancient Greece, they're sometimes problematic. This is also
true.
The catchphrase of my podcast, basically.
Absolutely.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Are the old world picturesque shores of Europe calling you? Set sail on an adventure with Avalon Waterways. Enjoy an elevated cruising experience. Avalon Waterways offers smaller ships, bigger experiences with fewer people and more of, well, everything good about river cruising. Don't just dream about quaint towns and cobblestone villages. See them for yourself and make lasting memories. Discover limited time offers today at avalonwaterways.com.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun. Such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of seven kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th, just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Actually, that kind of segues into... Could I talk a little more about Eros's character?
Please.
So I think I talked a little more about building the character of Psyche, but Eros, in like the first draft, he was very thin. Like his character was very thin. And I was like, okay, I got to add more. And for him, I remixed a little bit of Hesiod into it, where Hesiod names him as one of the primordial gods. And then there's a later philosopher, Empedocles, who cites Eros and Eris, who is desire and discord, as two of the central principles of the universe. So Eros, in my novel, is one of the primordial deities. And he has this sister named Eris, who is kind of his opposite. They don't really get along very well. There's a lot of tension there.
No one can get along with Eris. That's her whole deal.
Of her entire point.
Yeah, this
is true. But he, you know, what is it like to be this primordial god and to be faced with this new world and new universe in which you should participate in its creation? And he's just like, nah, I'm going to take a nap. And throughout the novel, he has this very like contrary, wry, jaded character. He's been around for thousands of years. He's not really impressed by things. He doesn't really want the powers he has. And for that characterization, I drew a lot on Aaron Carson's scholarship of and depictions of Eros as sweet bitter in Greek sources. That love can be wonderful and lovely, but it's also, it can be awful as well.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I love Anne Carson generally. I've not read it. I guess it's all coming from Eros, the Bittersweet, that book. That's been on my list forever. It's sitting right behind me and I've still not read it. But I mean, generally, she's the best. That's the translation of Orestes that I've been working on for this series, because if there's an Anne Carson translation, I'm going to use it. But yeah, that's really fascinating to play with that primordial aspect of him, because it's so unique. And Hesiod is so interesting in how he handles it too, because he also he has this primordial Eros, and then he also kind of simultaneously has an Eros who's seemingly birthed alongside Aphrodite after, you know, the Uranus castration. And it's always kind of fascinated me when I try to explain it to my listeners. I like to call them big love and little love. Like, this idea of like the primordial Eros being like the very concept of love as a thing, whereas the little Eros is more like, I'm going to make you fall in love with this person. It might end in tragedy, you know, but it's still love. And that, so I like the ideas, like just generally surrounding that. So I can imagine playing with that really primordial aspect must have been very fun because it's so unique. There's not a lot of primordial gods that actually like do anything in myth.
Very, very primordial, but also very human, which is, you know, one of the fun things about the Greek gods. So you start thinking about like, all right, what would it be like for me to face this primordial world? That sounds tiring. I would like to take a nap, actually.
It's so long. Life is so long if you're primordial.
Life is so long. There's, you know, there's not really any challenges or goals to hit when you're a god. And then also, I had mentioned before, I do social work now, and I work primarily with older adults. I help grandmas mostly. I help them stay in their homes, get health care, get food, all of those things. But the perspective you get from working with seniors is really interesting because the amount of heartbreak and tragedy and triumph that a human being has seen by 70 or 80 years old, you're like, wow, I'm kind of glad we get closure on that. I'm glad we get an end to our stories. And thinking about what that would be like on a timeline of thousands of years of all of the betrayal and suffering and broken friendships you would have seen by then.
Yeah,
was something that really influenced the story as well.
Yeah, what an interesting perspective to come from. That's really interesting.
One of my favorite things about elder care social work is the stories you hear.
Yeah,
like I've heard such wild stuff. Oh. And people are like, oh, I hope I'm not taking up your time. I'm like, no, tell me more. This is fascinating. And like, also we need to get this tax form so you can apply for this.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, yeah. And what a way to like use it, you know, in your writing too. That's wonderful. Well, so, I mean, are there any other characters that you want to talk about? I'm really bad at remembering to ask about certain ones, particularly when I'm like, but the women. So but like there are, you know, people that are not women in your book. And so yeah, is there anyone else that you kind of want to talk about in this way or mythologically or as a character or what have you?
I mean, Eros is the big one because he really surprised me. Like at first I was like, oh my God, what do I do with you? Like you're just kind of a dude here. But then as I delved more into the sources and Ann Carson's secondary scholarship, I was like, no, you've actually got some interesting stuff going on, Eros. And then Zephyrus as well. Like I think that's a tweak to the original myth that I'm really proud of, that the West Wind was originally just a form of transportation in Apuleius, but I wanted to hear about Zephyrus the character. And so he becomes kind of this trickster comic relief, but also like a deeply romantic and tragic character because of his connection with Hyacinthos, and that he doesn't stop loving Hyacinthos just because Hyacinthos is dead. And what's that like?
That's such an interesting usage too, because that story is so typically framed around Apollo that it's nice. I mean, Apollo is also like such a problematic god that like, yeah, it's nice to have that more about Zephyrus, who is, that's one of his very few like actual stories other than just like him being one of the winds. Yeah, I really enjoyed that you were able to include that. I will also just praise myself for a split second, which is that when I told that story, it's one of my favorite titles of all time because I was able to call it a Frisbee tragedy.
That is a combination of words that you don't get to say very often.
Exactly. And it's so accurate. And so I just had to say that again. But yeah, like, you know, it's also, it is a very tragic story. And so being able to do that is really lovely. That, like, were there any other gods? Like, you know, I talk about Apollo being problematic and stuff. Like, that's one of, talking about how dangerous and problematic the Greek gods are is like my favorite pastime. So was there any kind of that aspect that you were really keen to include, or just like the gods, the sort of periphery gods generally, like how did you kind of want to play with them and go about utilizing them?
Well, she's not peripheral, but Aphrodite has a major role because she's kind of the one that kickstarts the events of the Eros and Psyche myth and Apuleius and in mine. And it comes down to jealousy that Psyche is being compared to her, and Aphrodite is like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
And Aphrodite is very much the villain in my version and in Apuleius, but she's kind of a delicious villain. Like, she is, she's very sensual. She's, you know, not always direct about the way she gets revenge, but she's kind of a Sailor Moon villain.
Like, she, I love that.
You know, she has that sensuality, but also enormous power as well. And I thought that was fun to play around with. And my protagonists are often women in my writing, but my villains are also often women as well, because I think if you really want to be feminist and get the full scope of women's experiences, it's going to encompass all of that. And also in writing Aphrodite, you know, drawing on the story of Adonis and similar to Hyacinthos, that they're was this enormous love there, and now the mortal is dead and the god just has to keep on living with that heartbreak and that misery. And what's that like for them? And also, for the goddess of love, Aphrodite has a pretty rocky romantic past. Like, she's hitched with Hephaestus. She's not thrilled about that. She has this tasty affair with Ares that's hot and sizzling, and ends with them in a net on the floor of Olympus. That's awkward. There's Hermes, who is Hermes. Good God. so it's, you know, she doesn't have like a very smooth romantic trajectory herself, but she is the goddess of love. So, you know, I was curious to delve into that as well.
She's always been my favorite goddess for those reasons, because, yeah, she just doesn't fit into anything. And she also, like, gets to kind of do what she wants. Like, she's married to Hephaestus, but it doesn't really stop her from anything. And, yeah, she's such a fascinating character, especially when you get to play with these villain aspects, because she gets to be more, you know. She's a villain, but she's also the goddess of love. And, like, there's just so much to her that, like, the sort of complexity and depth is sort of inherently there. And then so much more to work with on your end to kind of like play around with what all of those things mean, you know, the sort of good and the bad sides to these people.
Yeah, exactly. And in Apuleius, like, it's something I couldn't really pull into my version, but there's this idea of Venus as the generative principle of the universe. That's really interesting. Like, she's not just this piddly goddess of love. She's sort of this celestial, powerful, very holistic goddess. But I couldn't, I didn't really have time to pull that in.
Yeah, that's fair. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I had editors who were like, please stop putting in every opinion you've ever had. Please calm down.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like me trying to write anything about Greek myth, because there's just so much there, and so much lives inside my head. Yep, and I've opinions on everybody and everything, and yeah, it's endless in the best possible way. Yeah, well, I mean, this has been incredibly fascinating. Are there any other, like, specific things you want to share about the book, just because you want to talk about them, or you think my listeners would want to know, or really anything?
I think that's the biggest thing. If it's all right with you, I would love to talk a little bit about book two.
Yes, please. I never know kind of how much you want to share about that kind of stuff. So yes, oh my gosh.
So book two, I'm delving into The Argonautica by our boy Apollonius Rhodius.
Yes.
And I'm centering around three unlikely heroes in it, who are Jason, Atalanta, and Medea. So yes, you get to see the younger version of Atalanta that you saw in Psyche and Eros. And also Medea is just so fascinating to me. Like, we have the one source on Psyche and Eros, but we have, I mean, I think a dozen that mention Medea. Like, she's so well attested to. She's so complicated. The child murder thing might be a Euripides fanfic.
Yes. And yet it's still fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Which is also really interesting. Like, I do love the play Medea by Euripides. But she's so complicated. And actually, Jason is a lot more complicated and compelling than I originally thought.
Really?
Like, I think I did not go in with high expectations for Jason. I went in very low expectations. Yeah. But I do, I mean, I love the visual of him showing up at the Palace at Iolcus and confronting Peleus and wearing one sandal. Like,
he's
Jason,
so weird, yeah?
Absolute dingus. Like, just take the other sandal off. No, he shows up with one sandal. Mm-hmm. What a dingus. But also he has this speech partway through the Argonautica where the other Argonauts are arguing and debating. And he's like, I just want to get all of you home. Like, I worry about something happening to you. I just want to get you guys home. And it's like, you know, is that Jason trying to represent himself in the best light, which he loves doing?
Does
or
he ever?
Is it a core of genuine feeling? Mm-hmm. And also the romance between Jason and Medea, which in many ways is so one-sided. Thinking about it from Jason's perspective is interesting. What do you do when this incredibly powerful witch girl is really into you and can really help you with your goal of getting all your guys home? Which is, you know, I think I'm more partial to Medea here, but
good.
I was a little surprised by how much I didn't completely despise Jason. I mean, he still sort of sucks, but
yeah,
you know,
I have a lot of, there's often a lot of debate on my show about who's worse between Jason and Theseus. I will stand by. It's always Theseus. No question.
I was going to say Theseus would be my vote there.
Yeah. I think there's really no argument to be made, but a lot of people disagree with me. But from my perspective, how I've always seen Jason, like aside from Euripides, because then I think he's like a true villain. But otherwise I find him to just be so like simple. Like he's just very surface level. Like everything kind of happens to him and around him. And he's just kind of there for everything.
I see him as like almost a little bit bumbling and very ordinary. Like when the Argonauts pull up to the land of the Bebrycians and there's this fist fight between Polydeuces and the Bebrycian king, and eventually all the Argonauts have to go and fight. Like Jason's the last one to jump off the ship.
Yeah.
and that's from a writer who is partial to Jason.
Yes.
So I don't know. I have developed a soft spot for Jason that I think might be somewhat Stockholm syndrome.
I respect that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really Medea and Atalanta that I'm really interested in in the upcoming novel. And there's because they were the only two women on the Argo.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that like?
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot of similarities in their sense of agency, but they also really differ in their methods, where Medea is this witch who works on the margins and Atalanta is kind of a jock, you know? So what would it be like to meet for them to meet each other? There's a fragment in Diodorus Siculus that mentions Medea healing Atalanta after a battle. And I was like, all right, I've written enough fanfic to make this work.
Yes.
So I also kind of want to explore a sapphic element as well.
Amazing.
Because of who I am as a person.
I mean, I respect this. Also, ancient Greece needs more of it because Sappho was literally there. So
I know.
Like, come on. Also, she's like basically on the route of, you know, the Argonautica. So that's just me stretching it. But, you know, Lesbos is right
that
there.
That could be fun.
Yeah. It's
let's
right
go meet
there.
Sappho, guys.
Or at the very least, go to Lesbos, you know? Yeah, I love that. That's really interesting. And like, I was going to ask, because I know, you know, Atalanta, for all that she is often seen as a member of the Argo or of the Argonauts on the Argo, she is not in Apollonius's Argonautica. And that's always so interesting. So yeah. So are there a lot of sources when it comes to Atalanta and Medea together?
So it's really just that one fragment in Diodorus Siculus, but then there's Apollodorus, who specifically names Atalanta as a member of the Argonauts.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, man, we got like half a dozen different Argonauticas.
Oh, I
we
know.
We have the Orphic Argonautica. We have Valerius Flaccus, who's it's not really worth reading. Diodorus Siculus and his Library of History, describing the journey of the Argonauts, which I really like Diodorus Siculus. He's very interesting.
Yes, his Medea is incredible. Like his Medea is where we get so many fascinating things about her that don't exist anywhere else.
Yeah,
I absolutely love him, like for Medea alone and Hecate, because I think he's the one who makes her Hecate's daughter.
Exactly.
Too, right?
Yes. Which that's really interesting too. Like Medea's associated with Hecate throughout the myths, but Diodorus Siculus is the one who names Hecate as her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that like? All right, mom, come on, let's go do witchcraft.
Right. Yes. I think basically I've only read him in relation to the witches because he provides so many like newer insights into their characters, and I love it. That's really fun. I always wish like Apollodorus gave us more of anything.
Yeah.
Somebody once called him the TLDR of Greek myth, and I just think that's so accurate that I'll never forget it. Where it's like, thanks for like these really simple statements. So I generally know what happened, but like, could you have just been like, just could you just have elaborated like a little bit more, dude?
Yeah. Could you give us a little more? Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. We're missing out. So that's absolutely fascinating. I'm excited to hear that is what the next project is, because any more Medea in the world, I think, is a good thing.
It's my understanding there's a few different Medea retellings coming mm-hmm. through the pipeline.
I'm talking to somebody in just a few weeks about Savage Beasts, which comes
yes.
out.
Yes. Oh, I've started that. It yes. is delightful.
Oh, I'm so excited. I haven't started it yet. But it's, yeah, Ronnie, hoping I'm pronouncing her name right, but she hasn't been on my show yet to tell me, so I'm sorry. But yeah, I'll be speaking with her about that retelling, which is so fascinating because it's like so not in Greece, which is so unique.
And, yeah, and she's, yeah. I mean, she puts Medea into British-controlled India mm-hmm. as in Bengali princess, I think.
Mm.
So Ronnie is highlighting all of these really interesting questions of race and gender and colonization that I think really speak to the myth. Like mm-hmm. In Euripides' play, it's Medea's status as a foreign woman that really makes her position after Jason leaves her so precarious.
Exactly.
Where is she going to go? What yeah. is she going to do?
Yeah, she's a barbarian, you know? Yeah. She can't just live amongst the Greeks like anyone else. It's, yeah. I know. It's fascinating.
I also find like one of Jason's lines in Euripides fascinating, where he's explaining to Medea, like he's leaving her, he's breaking up with her, and he's like, but Medea, this is going to be good for our children, because they'll be the stepsons of a king.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, Jason, what's going on? Do you actually believe that? Mm-hmm. Are you performing again? Like, there's a lot, I think, discussed and written about Medea's performance in Euripides, that she's always telling people what they want to hear. She's mm-hmm. always putting on a mask, but Jason is doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love Euripides more than anything. So, I mean, yeah, everything he does is perfect. but yeah, I mean, God, all of these characters, I could talk about them forever, but this has been so much fun. I could talk about myths forever, and so just having someone on to talk about not only your book but also just like mythology broadly is such a thrill. So thank you
so much. This is, I think I mentioned before, this is my first interview for the novel and my first podcast interview ever, and I really appreciate it being with someone who is so lovely and curious about the myths and kind.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it was a good experience. I do love nerding out with fellow Greek myth nerds, so I always
it's
know
really
it's
honestly
well.
That has been one of my favorite parts of the publishing journey so I far bet. Is just like just vibing about myths with people.
Yeah, like we're all out there. If my entire life has proved anything, like there are so many people who want to nerd out about myths and nerd out about like really intricate details. Like yeah. when I don't have authors on, I have academics, and they're like, here, let me tell you about my research into this like really specific concept. And those get just as many downloads as everything else in my podcast. And that is always such a thrill to me that like just any old nerd on the internet wants to hear about the most like niche ancient Mediterranean nonsense. And it's, yeah, it's
like,
really
yes,
fun.
Tell me about incantation balls. Want to
yes!
hear all about them.
Like, this nerdery has given me a career. I will take it. Yeah, so no, such a thrill to do this. So I will be, mentioning in the introduction and outro, which I record separately because I cannot sound scripted in front of other humans, about where to get your book and when and things. And this episode will come out around when it is released. But is there anything you want to share? Any kind of, I don't know if there's any kind of special publication stuff you want to share or know that you should be. It's fine if there isn't either.
I don't think there is. I think the UK pub date is May 25th, US pub date is June 13th, and you can get it anywhere books are sold.
Hell yeah. Amazing. Oh, nerds, nerds, nerds. You are all so cool and nice. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I do love talking to authors and anyone else who has such deep and fun knowledge of the ancient realm and its sources. Luna was such a joy to speak to, and I hope you all check out her novel, Psyche and Eros, because gods, who doesn't need a new version of their story? Psyche is so fun, their story is so fun, and I can't wait for you all to see how Luna has handled it. So, you know, find it wherever you get your books. I think it's available most places where English books are sold. And follow Luna on all the places that she mentioned. I have linked to them in the episode's description, as always. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you get access to bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click on the link in this episode's description. Thank you all. You're the best. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
See new things, try new things, go back centuries while living in the moment, forge new paths while discovering old ones, pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th, just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.